So I went down to my favorite store, picked out three or four shirts or more, a pair of pants and a striped tie, and the man came by and said, "Yes, sir, cash or charge?" I said, "Just put it on my credit card."
Just put it on my credit card. Yes, we've all done it, or a lot of us have anyway. Maybe some of us haven't. But it's a credit-focused On Your Money today without Kevin McKinley and without Joy Cardine. John Munson in for Joy Cardine for On Your Money this week. We'll be talking about credits, credit and credit cards, credit scores, credit reports, and all things credit this hour on Your Money. My guest is John Ultimer, a nationally recognized expert on credit reporting, credit scoring, and identity theft. He's president of the Ultimer Group, LLC, and president of consumer education at CreditSesame.com. Welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. I love this topic, and can't wait to get it on.
Well, I've seen, and I think a lot of other people have seen, a real uptick in the number of offers for credit cards that I've been getting in the mail. And at one time, I know I filled out a form and sent it to somebody saying I didn't want to see any of these things in my mailbox. All of a sudden, I'm getting from the same bank two and three a week, and other people are reporting the same thing. Why are we seeing so many more offers of credit right now?
Yeah, the reason your mailboxes are filling up with credit card offers is because we're about 4 months away from the busiest shopping season of the year. And credit card issuers recognize that opening a new credit card account is somewhat cyclical and not necessarily an exact science, and it's really subject to the timing of the prospective cardholder. So that's why you see multiple offers from the same bank seemingly over and over and over again, because today you may not want a card, but in 2 weeks you may actually want one or need one. So they're really peppering the consumer right now, trying to get them to open a card well in advance of essentially Black Friday, so that they have it in their wallet, it's been activated, they're used to using it, and hopefully their hypothesis is, look, let's get one in their wallet just before the busiest time shopping season of the year, and hopefully we'll use my card for all that shopping.
Well, and on the outside of the envelope, it says, 0% APR for 12 to 14 months. And then, of course, you open it up and read the fine print. And after that introductory period, it goes to something in the 20s for interest. The idea, the enticement is, well, this is free money. Just go ahead and use it. But that's kind of that can be a real trap for people.
It is, and one of the adages that I always tell consumers to think about when they're thinking of opening a credit card offer and reviewing the fine print is that the big print giveth and the fine print taketh away. Most of those offers, those 0% offers, are actually pretty decent. You've got to have really good credit to get them. So for the people who are actually seeing those types of offers filling up their mailbox, they should feel pretty good about what their credit reports and credit scores look like, because people with, for example, FICO 550 are not getting those types of offers. So at the very least, it's flattering to get those. Now, if you want to use one of those cards, that's fine. The best way to use those cards is if you are carrying credit card debt elsewhere on a card that's actually accruing interest, meaning it's not a 0% type of card, and then you would move the balance off of a card with interest onto the card without interest and buy yourself some time, whether it's 6 months, and some of them are even as long as a year and a half, up to 18 months of 0% interest. So the most optimal use of that card is to move expensive credit card debt and make it cheaper credit card debt so that you can work to pay off the balances where you don't have to worry about interest rates.
Well, and that's really the key, isn't it? If you're going to do that, then you really do have to pay them off, because otherwise you're just putting off the inevitable and you're still going to end up paying all that interest.
Well, the only time you don't have to pay off debt is if you file bankruptcy. So, of course, if you're opening a card and you're using it, whether you're using it for cash advances or for new purchases or for a balance transfer, the credit card issuer eventually wants to get paid, because unless there are transactions taking place on that card, the credit card issuer is not making any money. And after the meltdown in 07 and 08, the credit card issuing community really focused more so on the revenue potential of a cardholder versus just the risk of doing business with somebody. I mean, someone who's got a stellar credit score may have all these credit cards with huge credit limits that may not actually use any of them, or if they use them, they use them very sparingly. Well, that's not necessarily a terribly profitable customer to the credit card issuer. So now really it's a mix of not only good risk, meaning good credit scores, but also the likelihood that you're actually going to use it. Because otherwise, they're just not making very much money, and it's too risky for them to allow you to have a $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 limit if you're not at least generating some revenue for them.
Well, in some ways, when you see the ads on television, hear them on the radio, you see them in magazines, you certainly see them in your mailbox, it seems sometimes, doesn't it, that these are kind of like the ads for various types of beer and other alcoholic beverages, which encourage people to consume them. But, you know, at the end, it is, well, be sure you drink responsibly. There's really a mixed message. We see all these people using these credit cards to achieve success in life and have nice things and dress in the latest fashions and so forth. But we want you to be responsible with credit. Don't get in over your head. There's really a mixed message there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point. And that's the one thing you do not see on any of these credit card commercials is the guy on the back end. When the bill comes in the mail and he opens it and his draw drops and he's like, how in the world am I going to make this minimum payment every single month for the next X number of years? That would be bad marketing for credit card issuers. You know, it's interesting. The most profitable credit card customer is also the riskiest credit card customer. It's someone who uses the card, uses it a lot, carries a large balance month after month, and therefore pays a lot of interest. That's a very profitable credit card customer. That's also the guy that they're the most terrified of, because the minute he or she loses their job or becomes underemployed, the first thing they're going to stop paying is the credit card, because they want to keep the house, they want to keep the car, but the credit card, there's really nothing for the bank to come and repossess, because they can't come repossess things that don't exist, like dinners and vacations and outings. So, you know, it's almost like that, it's that fine edge between too risky and too profitable that the credit card guys are. You know, it's one of the reasons why credit card debt is the riskiest type of debt on a credit report. You can have hundreds of thousands of dollars of mortgage debt on a credit report and still have fantastic credit scores, but you could have $10,000 or $15,000 of credit card debt and have average to below average credit scores.
Well, I want to go back to something you mentioned just a moment ago about how credit card companies make their money, because I think most of us probably are under the impression that where they make their money is from loaning it to people and then getting it back with interest. But what I'm hearing you say is that they do pretty well on transactions as well. Is that where the real money is in credit cards?
Yeah, there's three ways that credit card issuers make money. And let's throw charge cards in there as well, like the cards that you have to pay in full every month that you can't revolve a balance. Charge cards are the same way. They make money on fees. So, for example, if you have an annual fee, that's one way. If you pay late, you may pay a late fee. If you go over your limit, you may have an over-limit fee, foreign transaction fee. There's a whole list of fees that you may or may not have to pay depending on what credit card you have. That's one way they make money. Second is interest. And some people would actually consider interest a type of a fee. I don't. I consider it to be kind of a separate line item of revenue. And that's if you have a balance and you do not pay it in full every month, and you have incurred interest for that month for the ability to carry a balance from month to month. And then the third way, which most consumers have no idea about, is what's referred to as interchange or transaction income. Every time you use your card, so for those of you today who are going to use your credit card to fill up your tank or, you know, pay your cable bill online, the merchant is actually paying a fee for every single transaction for the ability to accept payment using that card. And that fee is generally somewhere in the neighborhood of 1% to 4% of the transaction. Now, that does not come out of your pocket. It comes out of the merchant's pocket. And generally, the merchant will subsidize that fee by charging you a little bit more for whatever it is that you're buying. And that's one of the ways that issuers make money. So even if you're not carrying a balance every month, and even if you have a card that has no sort of annual fee and you're able to avoid all the other fees, just simply the fact that you're using the card makes the issuer very happy and is likely to keep them you know, kind of on the sidelines with respect to closing your card or lowering your limit.
Mm-hmm. Now, the average American has between 5 and 7 credit cards. What do you make of that figure? Is that too many, or can that be okay in certain situations?
I think that's perfectly fine, and some people would say that's crazy. That you know, some people who are kind of on the wrong end of the stick would suggest you shouldn't have any credit cards ever, which I think is just unrealistic and makes your life much less efficient. And some people would say 5 to 7, you know, I've got more than that, so it's not a big deal. You know, here's my take on the issue. There's no optimal number for your credit score. So in other words, there is nothing in credit scoring that says if you have this number of cards, you're going to earn the most points for that category. It doesn't exist in FICO. It doesn't exist in VantageScore. So you shouldn't chase that number because you're really chasing a number that you're never going to hit. My suggestion is have enough cards so that you can shop efficiently, and I say that in a way that, you know, most retailers will accept all types of credit cards, but there still are pockets where you may find a retailer that doesn't accept a certain brand of card or a certain type of card, and so you want to have multiple cards of different types so that you don't run into an issue of not being able to pay for something. 5 to 7, obviously, you don't have to have 5 to 7 to function, and people who have 5 to 7 would generally have general use credit cards, and then also some retail store cards that are specific for a certain store or a certain chain of stores, but then they can't use them elsewhere. In my mind, those are horrible because the interest rates are incredibly high on those, and those credit limits are very low, which is basically a subprime card with a store brand stapled on the front of it. So, you know, if 2 cards works for you, then 2 cards is fine. If 10 cards works for you, then 10 cards is fine. There's very little risk, and this is something that people really don't understand. There's very little risk of fraud with credit cards for you. You're not going to lose any money. I mean, we talked about for in November and December, I talked about the Target data breach ad nauseum, and not one consumer lost a penny out of their pocket because of that data breach. And there are 110 million consumers whose information was exposed. We have very aggressive laws in this country that protect us and cap our liability for credit card fraud. The banks lose money, the retailers lose money, but we don't lose money. So 5 to 7 cards is fine, and some people would say, well, it's too many, there's a risk of fraud, when reality is that you have absolutely no risk of fraud. At most, it's going to be an inconvenience for you just to get another replacement card if one of your cards is stolen.
What about more than 7?
I'll tell you, know, the guy that you have on the phone with you right now has 13. I have 13 credit cards, and some people would say that's absurd. You don't need 13 cards, and to some extent, they're right. I don't need 13. I have 2 or 3 that I use either for personal use or for business use, and I use them seemingly 90% of the time unless I want to use another one just for some other reason. Maybe they're running a promotion on rewards or something. And one of the reasons I have that, and it's a little complex, is because I want to have a very, very large aggregate credit limit, because that's one of the things that credit scoring models love to see, is they love to see a lot of available credit on credit cards and a very low balance relative to that aggregate limit. So by having that many credit cards, I'm able to keep a very, very high credit limit on my credit reports, and even if I'm traveling extensively during the month for business or for personal, it's very unlikely that I'm going to have any sort of meaningful impact on my credit score because I've got such a large amount of available credit. I don't advise that for everybody, but for me it works, and I don't miss payments, and I don't carry balances, and my FICO score as of yesterday was 837, which is in the top 2%. So it works for me, and it can work for anybody as long as they pay their bills on time and they use the cards responsibly.
We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, I'd like to talk about which cards are best and worst, and then we'll get some audience questions about credit cards, credit scores, and credit reports. I have a few of my own in that regard, too, because a lot of times we get things confused. People get credit score and credit report confused and so forth, and what these scores actually mean. We'll talk about maybe how you can work to get a better score for yourself as well. So lots still to come on this special credit edition of On Your Money. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. My guest is John Oldsheimer, a nationally recognized expert on credit reporting and the holder of 13 credit cards. We'll be right back. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash.
It's On Your Money, a special credit edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley and Joy Cardine both on vacation this week. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. Joining me, John Oldsheimer, a nationally recognized expert on credit reporting. So let's talk about the best and worst credit cards that we can have. First of all, let's go worst to best. What's the worst kind of credit card to have?
The worst type of credit card to have is a retail store credit card. If I asked you to shut your eyes and I explained to you, here's a credit card that has an average interest rate of roughly 24.9%, which is a fancy way of saying 25%, and a credit limit of between $500 to $1,000 to start, you would say, hey, John, you're describing a subprime credit card. When in reality, I'm describing a retail store credit card. They're all structured the same way. And that makes carrying debt extremely expensive, likely the most expensive debt you'll ever carry, and 10 full percentage points higher than the average interest rate on a general use credit card, around 15%. There's also a usability problem, and it acts as an incentive to get a lot of them. I think we all know that you can only use a Macy's card at Macy's, and you can only use a Gap card at the Gap. And so retail store cards almost tend to beget more retail store cards, which means you're putting more of these really lousy cards in your wallet at the same time. And having such low limits is problematic for credit scores because, again, credit scores don't like balances that are too close to limits. And if you're opening a lot of those, especially to take advantage of the 10 and 15% discounts at the mall during the holiday shopping season, you're adding a lot of inquiries and new accounts to your credit reports, which are, again, not something your credit scores like to see. So there's really nothing good about them. And yes, my wife argues that she gets coupons in the mail, so she gets discounts at different retailers where she likes to shop, which is fine. But in the grand scheme of things, for consumers who are carrying balances on those cards, they're absolutely the worst type of plastic you possibly can.
Well, that's really the key, isn't carrying the balance? I mean, my mother, God bless her, who's rich in years and has a credit score that would make a really good SAT score, says that she doesn't use credit cards unless she's already got the cash. And then so it's just a convenience. So if you're not actually carrying a balance, those store cards can offer some discounts and some incentives that you might not get otherwise. But if you are carrying a balance, that really makes them bad.
That's right. And the way she's using the card and her attitude towards the card is not only very healthy, but that's what they were designed for in the first place, for efficient shopping, not to get into debt. So if you use the card just in lieu of cash because you just don't want to carry cash with you, but you intend to, and then you end up paying it off before the due date so you don't carry a balance and therefore pay no interest. And by the way, you probably earn some sort of rewards on your shopping because most cards these days earn or have some sort of rewards program associated with it. Then really you've done everything right. And the issuer is happy because you've used it and you're generating the transaction revenue for them. You're happy because you got whatever you wanted to get and don't have to carry around a bunch of cash. And your protections are very, very aggressive under the Fair Credit Billing Act. And it's a win-win-win across the board. For every one person like her, there are multiple people unlike her who are using the card as a supplement to an income, as a way to keep up with the Joneses, and are using the card irresponsibly and getting a balance at the end of the month that is shocking to them, and they can't make the payment in full, and then they really understand the full force of a 24.9% interest rate, which mm-hmm. is just brutally punishing. And the CARD Act, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, the CARD Act, which was something that the president signed back in 2009, the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act of 2009, the acronym is the CARD Act. The CARD Act requires the statement, your credit card statement, to include a disclosure. It's a little box that shows you exactly how long it would take to pay off your credit card debt if you did nothing but pay the minimum and how expensive it would be in interest by doing so. And I can tell you that consumers that I've spoken with who've seen that disclosure on their statement have thought that it was a mathematical error because they're like, there's no way it can cost me this much and take this long to pay this seemingly, you know, $4,000, $5,000 debt. How can that take 17 years to pay off and cost me, you know, $10,000 in interest? And that's what happens when you have such a high interest rate and you pay it off so slowly.
Now, we've talked about the worst kind of cards to have. What's the best kind of card to have?
You know, I personally like charge cards, and there's not many of them, okay? Amex is perhaps the only credit card issuer the only lender that issues charge cards. And charge cards are different than credit cards in that a charge card is what's referred to as a pay-in-full product, meaning that you don't have the option to carry a balance. So it almost forces you to stay out of credit card debt because you can't pay a minimum. You have to pay all of it by the due date. Most charge cards have annual fees because there's no interest income, so the issuer has to make money somewhere else, and so there's usually an annual fee associated with it. But the rewards programs on those cards are usually really, really great, and especially if you're a business traveler and you're loading up on points, it can be well worth the annual fee. So I put those at the top of the list simply because it has almost built-in credit interest insurance because you can't carry the balance.
And what happens if you don't pay off the balance?
Well, if you don't pay off the balance, then you're past due and you start incurring late fees. And obviously that's very problematic, and they're not going to let you roll very long like that before they shut you down. And the issuers that issue charge cards, and someone who's got bad credit is not going to be able to get a charge card, so let's just throw that out on the table. It's another product designed for people who understand how to manage credit properly. Because they recognize that many consumers depend on that 21-day grace period in order to make their either some payment or the payment in full, because it transcends at least one pay cycle for people who normally get paid twice a month. So they depend on that 21-day grace period. The charge card has no grace period. The charge card has no ability to roll a balance, and so you have to pay it by the end of the grace period, not just some of it. So it's targeted at consumers who have very good credit. You're not going to ever see a charge card marketed towards the subprime community.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about credit on this special edition of On Your Money. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley also off this week. My guest is John Oldtimer, a nationally recognized expert on credit reporting, credit scoring, and identity theft. He's president of the Oldtimer Group, LLC, and president of consumer education at CreditSesame.com. 800-642-1234 is our phone number. Let's go to Wally in Green Bay first today. Wally, hello.
Good morning. I've got a question about the incredible offers, like $200 after you spend $500, or after you charge $500. And then if you apply for that, well, what are the implications of applying for a card like that? Obviously, they know what I'm doing, and I have a plan to do that.
John Oldtimer, what are the implications of a card that's offering you $200 after you charge $500?
Yep. So what you've just identified is what I refer to as the signing bonus in the credit card world. You sign up for a card, you charge $500 on it, which is pretty modest. Most people will burn through that in a month pretty easily, and then all of a sudden, boom, you get a statement credit the next month for $200, which is essentially a 40% cashback bonus, which is unheard of in the credit card world. Most people get 1% cashback. But what these cards are doing is they're essentially buying customers with these signing bonuses. Here's the downside to doing it. And it's really not that big of a deal unless you do it a lot. The downside is that when you make an application for a credit card, the credit card issuer is going to pull one of your credit reports, which means you're going to have one credit card inquiry on one of your reports. Not the end of the world. When they open the account, they're going to put it on all three of your credit reports, which could lower the average age of your accounts because you've just added a brand new account. Again, not the end of the world, but it's something to be aware of and cognizant of, that it could lower your score. And then really that's about it, as far as the downside goes, unless you abuse the card. And that's always an issue, whether it's a newly opened card or a pre-existing card that's already in your wallet. Again, you're going to start seeing more and more of those types of offers with those aggressive signing bonuses after some small amount of usage, because they want you to open these cards just before the holiday season. So, if you want the card and you don't carry a balance and you're going to charge stuff anyways, it's not a bad way to earn $200 of free stuff, as long as you use the card responsibly.
Go ahead.
Quick question on the credit score. What is, you talk about good credit score, bad credit score. What's the magic number they use?
Yeah, so the magic number that the credit card issuer who's issuing that type of card, and again, that is a card targeted to a a consumer with very good credit. So if you're getting that card in the mail, you should be flattered because not your neighbor isn't getting that. You're going to have scores well into the 700s in order to get that type of offer. In today's lending environment, if you want to be in the safe zone, you need to have scores at least 750 to 760 across the board, meaning that all three of the credit reporting agencies, in order to put yourself in a position to get not only those types of cards, but the 0% interest balance transfer cards, and also interest rates in the 0% range for auto loans from the captive auto lenders, and interest rates in the 3 to 4% range for mortgage lenders, which, you know, I know people are critical of lenders, but that's about as good as it's been in the history of history as far as interest rates go. So, you know, this is one of the ways that having a good credit score pays off for consumers, is it allows them to pay less for things that they may have to finance anyways.
Wally, thanks for the call. Do credit card providers take note of who's using their rewards? And does that, if you use your rewards, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, they want you to use your rewards. They want you to use your rewards because the rewards program is not free to them. It's expensive to facilitate a rewards program as a credit card issuer. So yes, they want you to use the card, they want you to earn points, and they want you to redeem them and claim them. They don't want you to rack up a ton of points and then never ever use them. Because then there's an argument that you're not getting value out of the rewards program, and then you're less likely to stick around and you may become tempted by some type of other competing credit card offer. And rewards programs have gotten really good lately. Airline miles, points that can be converted to things like gift cards or merchandise or statement credit, cash back, and of course there's nothing wrong with cash back. Some credit cards even will some will donate to charities. I don't really like those types of cards. I'd rather control my own donating. But some credit cards will actually use the rewards points and the money you've earned and actually deposit that into a retirement account, like an IRA or a 529 college savings plan. They're called retirement rewards credit cards. And those are great because most of the time when you claim your rewards, you claim them and you use them and then they're gone, right? You took the airline flight or you already used the gift card and it's now gone. But with the retirement rewards cards, you're actually accruing value because they tend to grow over time. So there's a lot of really good rewards card options these days.
800-642-1234. Let's go next to Art in Milwaukee. Art, hello.
Hi. So I'm calling both as a retail provider and a consumer. So we were told that it was not allowed, and I thought illegal, to charge less for a cash payment than for a credit card payment. But now I see lots of gas stations that have one price per gallon if it's a cash and a higher price if it's for credit. So I'm interested in that. And you also just mentioned something about retirement cards, and I don't know anything about those. If you can expand on that, that would be great too.
Sure. So let me hit the first one. And many consumers have probably started seeing over the past couple of years variable pricing. Gas stations, it's a good example. Liquor stores, a better example. Convenience stores, a great example. Some restaurants are actually doing it where you get, you know, this is your price if you pay with cash and this is your price if you pay with credit. And essentially what they're doing is trying to give you an incentive to pay with cash, because then if you pay with cash, then they don't pay the swipe fee because you're not swiping anything. There is no credit card transaction taking place. There was a lawsuit a couple years ago against the credit card networks that essentially forced the networks to acquiesce on that restriction that their merchants not be allowed to charge a better price for a cash transaction, which is why you've started to see some merchants choose to do so. Some merchants are choosing not to do so. They just are keeping it clean and having one price for everything. But yes, if you, and I don't know what cards you accept, you probably accept multiple types of cards, check with your network provider and ask them, hey, look, are you subject to this class action lawsuit? And if you are, you know, you have a choice as a retailer. You can now have variable pricing for your merchandise based on how they choose to pay. The retirement cards, there are several of them. Fidelity issues them, Charles Schwab issues them, and essentially they're American Express cards. And instead of earning, you know, airline miles and things like that, you earn cash back. And the cash back either can be mailed to you in the form of a check, which some people take, or it can be deposited into an existing Fidelity or Charles Schwab account into your IRA. If you're funding a 529 for a relative, then you can deposit it there. So it's really a matter of where you choose to apply the rewards that you're earning. And it's interesting, those cards do not have annual fees. They're very, very consumer friendly, and they tend to have very, very high credit limits, which is also something that's very consumer friendly. But again, those are going to be reserved for people who've got solid credit.
Art, thanks for the call. John Oldsheimer, we've talked about rewards. What about fees? Are there any particular kinds of fees we should be aware of when using or carrying plastic?
Yeah, and credit cards have a pretty bad reputation, unfairly in my mind. There are a lot of, you know, kind of blabbermouth talking heads who choose to demonize credit cards and don't really give them credit for how good they actually are and how good they are as far as the protections go. There are credit cards that have annual fees. There are credit cards that do not have annual fees. There are credit cards that have late payment fees. Well, that makes sense, right, because you shouldn't be late. There are cards that have foreign transaction fees, meaning if you go use your card out of the United States as part of the currency conversion, there's going to be a fee associated, usually up no more than 3% of whatever you purchase. But that can add up, especially if you take a long vacation abroad somewhere. There are also cards that have absolutely positively no fees of almost any kind unless you do something punitive, like you pay late or you charge over your limit, something that you know you shouldn't be doing, you've misbehaved, so you kind of expect some sort of fee as a punishment. But this rumor that credit cards are expensive and that you're always getting nailed with fees is just absolutely incorrect. There are over 10,000 financial institutions in this country. Mostly, you know, that number is inflated because of the number of credit unions in the U.S., and every single one of them issue credit cards, and the vast majority of them issue credit cards that have no fees or are fees that are easy to avoid, like the late fees. Yes, there are cards that have fees. I in my mind, I don't think an annual fee on a card is an automatic disqualifier for the card. If you balance the fee with what you're getting in rewards or in exchange for the fee, and it works out in your favor, then the fee is really meaningless. And most annual fees on credit cards are, you know, $49, $79. I mean, they're less than the cost of a dinner for two. So it's not something that is really excessive. There are cards, however, that have annual fees in the several hundred dollars. Some of the elite credit cards that most people can't get have fees in the thousands of dollars. But again, you have to always balance that with what you're actually getting in exchange for the fee before you just have a knee-jerk reaction and automatically, you know, disqualify them off your list.
And, you know, it's all about value then. In other words, it's like purchasing anything else. You're buying money or renting it anyway, and at the end, you have to determine what the value of the transaction is, not just the price.
I think that's a very good point. Let me give you a personal example, and I don't mind sharing this. I have a Delta Reserve credit card. It's one of the Sky Miles cards, and I live in Atlanta, and that's a Delta hub, and so when I fly Delta almost exclusively because they have the most flight options for me because of where I live. The Delta Reserve card has a $450 annual fee, and most people would say, you are crazy to have a card with that type of fee, but I get a free companion ticket every year. I get free access to their Sky Club, which is all these rooms in the airports where I get free internet, you know, a comfortable seat, a quiet room, free drinks. That by itself is over $400 a year to sign up for. And for people who travel a lot, that's a very valuable perk because it allows them to decompress when they're sitting at the airport for 4 and 5 hours rather than sitting in the tiny chair with a screaming kid next to you. So it's and plus the miles that you're able to earn on that card allow you to move up on the priority list for things like first-class upgrades, which, again, is very nice if you travel a lot. So, again, for me, if I had to price all those things out separately at retail, it would be considerably more than what I'm paying in an annual fee. So for me, the $450 is actually cheap relative to what I'm getting in return. So sure. You have to look at it that way versus just looking at the dollar amount and saying, oh, my God, too much. I'm not going to get that car.
Well, it's what you think is important to you. I mean, so if a person didn't mind sitting in a small, uncomfortable chair next to someone holding a screaming baby in an airport waiting area, then, you know, they wouldn't want to pay the $450. It's what's important to you. Credit scores are important. We need to talk about those also. And people are also are lining up with questions about how to protect ourselves from credit card fraud. We did touch on that a little bit earlier. But a lot of us see offers from third-party companies who want to help us avoid credit card fraud. And I'd like to also get your views on some of those. We've got some callers and more to come. We'll continue this special episode of On Your Money, a credit-focused edition. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. My guest is John Oldsheimer, a nationally recognized expert on credit reporting, credit scoring, and identity theft. His website is johnoldsheimer.com, and he and I will both be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Gotta get me some dollars and cents, dollars and cents.
It's a special credit-focused edition of On Your Money today on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is also off this week, so we're taking the opportunity to talk to a credit card expert and answer your questions about credit. John Oldsheimer is a nationally recognized expert on credit reporting, credit scoring, and identity theft, president of the Oldsheimer Group, LLC, and president of consumer education at CreditSesame.com. Let's take a call. We'll go to Mary in Platteville next. Mary, hello.
Hi. You just gave the perfect lead into my very question. I'm getting a third-party solicitation. They're asking $189 for a three-year term of credit card protection against fraud or improper use. And I'm wondering if I already have that kind of protection from the actual card provider itself, or if this is something I need to look into.
Save your money and, you know, spend your $189 elsewhere where you're actually going to get value out of it.
You can donate it to public radio. That would be acceptable.
True.
Yeah.
Well done.
That's
well
actually
done.
An excellent idea. So I probably have those very same protections they're touting to offer me through the direct card provider. Is that correct?
Yeah, you have incredible protections. Let me spend 2 minutes to talk about the Fair Credit Billing Act, which most people know nothing about. The Fair Credit Billing Act, which is a federal statute, so regardless of whether you live in Wisconsin or any other state, these apply to you. That's the federal statute that caps your liability on credit card fraud to $50. So at worst, if someone were to steal your credit card or compromise the number and go out and go crazy with it, at worst, the most you could be held liable for is $50. Okay. On top of that, all four of the major credit card networks, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express, all have zero fraud liability policies. So despite the fact that your issuer could hold you responsible for $50 of any fraud, the issuers themselves say, no, we're not going to hold you liable for any of it. So there is no way you're going to lose any money from credit card fraud because of not only the federal statute, but also the protections offered by the credit card network. So I'm not sure what the $189 is supposed to help protect you from, but your liability financially anyways is pretty much zero. So unless there's something else that's part of their protection that's really worth $189, I don't see the value there.
Well, what about identity theft as separate from credit card fraud? People's identities are being compromised, and there are companies that are offering to protect you against that. Your Social Security number could be revealed or stolen in some way. Someone could file a false tax return on your behalf and get a refund, all that kind of thing we hear about in the news all the time. So are there legitimate companies that provide services that protect us from that kind of identity theft and fraud?
Yes, and you've named a variety of different types of fraud, from tax fraud down to essentially true name fraud to credit card fraud. It depends on which one you're concerned about, because there's really nothing that protects you from all of them, despite what the commercials may be saying. If you feel like that your identity has been compromised or otherwise exposed, and you want to place or you want to monitor your credit reports, then there are two ways to do that. You can either pay for it, and there are definitely subscription services that are going to run you about $189 a year, because they're generally around $15 to $16 a month as a subscription that auto bills to a credit card. And what they do is they monitor your three credit reports passively, and any changes to the credit report that could be indicative of fraud, like a new address or a new account hitting the report or a new credit inquiry, those are all indicative of someone applying for credit. They're going to send you some sort of an alert, either through email or through a text message. And most of the times those are false positives, meaning that you actually did go out and apply for a car loan, so you're not a victim of fraud, but you just got the alert anyways because it appeared suspicious. There are free services that do those things as well. So depending on you can find them online. They're not hard to find. Credit Sesame offers one. The company that I do work for offers a free credit monitoring service. So, again, before you go out and start spending a lot of money on these things, you know, look at your free options first because there are a lot of them. Now, that's credit monitoring. Credit monitoring is very reactive, meaning that it tells you after something has already happened. And some people are critical of it because of that. Well, thank you for telling me after the fraud has occurred. What can you do for me that will prevent it from happening in the first place? And there actually is something you can do, and it's called a security freeze. Some people call it a credit freeze. What you're doing with a security freeze or a credit freeze is you're basically telling the credit reporting agencies to take your credit reports out of circulation, which means that no lender with whom you do not have an existing relationship can get access to it. And, of course, no lender who can't pull your credit report is going to underwrite a loan in your name. It doesn't work that way. A credit freeze, it is not free unless you've already been the victim of identity theft. And then if you have been a victim, then it is free. In the state of Wisconsin, people who are residents have to pay $10 to freeze their credit report. And if you have three credit reports, that's $30. That's a one-time fee. It's not monthly. So it's a heck of a lot cheaper than paying a monthly subscription for credit monitoring. So it depends on how aggressive you want to get, how concerned you are, how much you think you truly have been exposed. If you haven't been exposed, then doing any of these things may be, you know, may be overreacting. But if you have been a victim or if you have a relative who is elderly and doesn't use credit any longer, the credit freeze is actually a pretty darn good alternative.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, thanks for the call, and remember to make your pledge at WPR.org. Let's go next to Cheyenne in Marshfield. Cheyenne, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So a few years ago, I graduated from high school and I became financially dependent. At the same time, my mom declared bankruptcy. I've been on my own for a few years, but as soon as I moved out, I had a couple of electricity bills go to the collection agency, as well as a few hospital bills. A few of those are paid off, a few of them aren't. As well as I have $30,000 in student debt. When I checked my credit score, it was extremely low. It was in the 300 range. And my mom checked her credit score at the same time, who, I remind you, declared bankruptcy a few years back, and hers was much higher than mine. Hers was in the high 500s. So I'm just curious how that system worked.
Yeah, so just to put that in perspective, and it does sound like a huge difference in the scores, both of those scores, the 300 and the high 500, are both within the lowest 5% nationally. So no lender is looking at your mom saying, wow, she's a pretty good credit risk.
Okay.
When you have your discussion over Thanksgiving dinner, if she tries to brag, you can let her know about that. What you've run into is what a lot of young people run into. It's things that are, almost silly, right? Utility bill. I mean, your intention probably was to pay it, but for some reason you didn't pay. I mean, we're not talking about $10,000 of credit card debt here. Utility bills tend to be pretty modest. Medical bills, believe it or not, medical bills are a lightning rod topic, okay? On one hand, you have the industry that says, look, defaulted medical bills are a default, just like a default on a credit card. And on the other side, consumer advocates, politicians, and even some lenders are saying, medical bills are really not a credit. They're not an extension of credit. People don't choose to get sick. You get sick, you may have been injured, you have these medical bills, you may or may not be insured. You didn't choose to incur that debt. You had to incur it out of necessity. So we don't consider a default on that type of debt to be the same as a default on an auto loan or a credit card bill, where you knew what you were getting into in the first place. And there's actually, believe it or not, there is a bill that has been, it's actually been introduced for four consecutive years called the Medical Debt Responsibility Act. And the MDRA, if it were ever passed, which unfortunately the chances are very little, if it were ever passed, it would actually require the credit reporting agencies to delete all medical collections from your credit report once it's been settled or paid. I mean, it still has to be addressed, but it would eventually, but it would be deleted. The newest version of the VantageScore credit score ignores paid collections. So even the credit scoring guys are now kind of not acquiescing, but they're adjusting their models to account for consumers who have gone into default on obligations, but have made good on them eventually by either paying them or settling them. They're actually rewarding them for doing so, which in my mind makes perfect sense. I mean, give people an incentive to pay their bills, and they will do so. So I'm going to throw some numbers on the table, and they're going to be pretty scary, but, you know, I'm not on the show to lie to you and sugarcoat things. Those types of things stay on your credit reports for up to 7 years, and they're going to have an impact on your score the entire time they're there. Your mom, on the other hand, gets to deal with the bankruptcy for 10 years because that's how long those stay on credit reports, and her scores are going to be lower for the entire period of time. They will go up organically over time as those items age, but your scores will never be in the elite range while those are on your credit reports. The best thing for you to do now is to pay them or settle them, which means get them to a $0 balance as quickly as possible, because then you eliminate the possibility of being sued by the creditor or the collection agency, which can happen. And, of course, then you can't ignore that, because then you have, you know, a court date, a judge. And if you don't show up, you lose by default, and then you'll end up with a judgment on your credit report, which is another 7 years. So pay them, settle them, draw a line in the sand and pay all your obligations on time going forward, and you'd be very surprised. Within 12 to 24 months, you'd be very surprised just how quickly your scores are going to start to rebound.
Cheyenne, good luck. Here's an email from Margaret who says, when looking at my credit report, I see I have a number of credit cards listed that I no longer use. I had contacted the companies asking to close the accounts and thought this had been done. How can I finally get these credit cards off my credit report?
If they're in good standing, meaning that they've been paid on time, you just chose to stop using them and close them, they don't automatically come off your credit report when they're closed. The credit reporting agencies will maintain them for a decade, for 10 years. And you believe it or not, you want that to happen. You do not want them to remove good accounts. Having a good credit history is almost like having, making great grades in high school or great grades in college. Yes, it was some time ago, but you never want that to go away. You always want people to be able to recognize that. So when you pay things off and you close them, don't ever argue with the credit reporting agencies about removing them, because then you're going to remove positive history, and that actually, believe it or not, could lower your credit scores. The bad stuff, meaning defaults like your previous caller, the defaulted credit card bills, defaulted obligations that end up in collections or with late payments on the credit report, federal law requires those to be removed in 7 years. And so those will stick around, unfortunately, for 7 years, and then the credit reporting agencies will delete them as the seven-year period rolls around. You don't need to do anything. You don't have to proactively contact them and say, hey, I think it's been 7 years, go ahead and remove these. They have basically a clock associated with everything derogatory on a credit report, and once that clock, once the alarm goes off, then they delete it automatically.
We've just got like 30 seconds left. Can you give us one parting word of wisdom for us on how to get the most out of our credit cards?
Well, the way to get the most out of your credit cards, and this is how I use them kind of strategically, is every single thing that I know that I have to pay for every single month, other than my mortgage, I charge on my credit card. Everything. And then I know I'm going to pay it off in full, so not only am I earning points, but I'm not incurring interest, and it's efficient, it's safe. I do it online, so I save the money on stamps. It's very, very fast. So in my mind, it's almost like the optimal use of a credit card. And that's truly the way people should be doing it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, John Oldsheimer. Appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, On Your Money airs on Tuesdays at 8 and Tuesday nights at 9 and Sunday mornings at 7. Kevin McKinley will be back next week. Bill Martin's produced this hour of programming. We had on-air production from Justin Williams, and Bill Martin's also directed today. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.